God damn it, I swear to God, when I get my hands on that swine herd, I don't even know what I'm gonna do.
You gotta make him pay, man. I mean, that stuff he was doing was not cool.
He's been porking my wife for months.
He's a bastard. And a swine herd to boot. I'm so glad we're finally going to give him a taste of his own medicine. No, wait, that makes it sound like we're gonna have sex with him. I'm so glad that we are going to go beat that guy senseless.
Wait, no, hang on. I was just planning to destroy him emotionally and ruin him financially. You can beat him up if you want. That's not really my style.
Oh my god! He's been beaten to death with his own hock of ham! Not a metaphor. I guess that saves us a lot of work, at least. Hey, wait! Isn't that your wife over there?
No, that's just a particularly shapely pile of hams. Listen, we gotta get focused on the task at hand. Don't you understand how bad this looks? Don't you know that we're gonna get done for it? They'll have us banged to rights. This couldn't possibly get any worse.
Oh, shit, it's that guy. Try to act natural. Hello.
Ah, madame et monsieur. Bonjour. Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Hugh de Parrot. I am the world's most famous medieval detective. Alors, is that the body of the swineherd I was just coming to buy ham from? For my Sunday morning ham?
I know it looks like that, but it's actually just a pile of incriminatingly stacked hams.
Madame, do not attempt to deceive Poirot. Poirot sees and knows all.
He always talks about himself in the third person. This is very standard.
You, Mr. Aaron Prinstep, were you not heard last night after consuming copious flagons of ale, insisting that...
I am going to find that man, and I am going to beat him to death with his heaviest cut of meat.
But... that doesn't incriminate me at all. I mean, I was there. I can attest that he said it, but I didn't say that.
You are a most slippery character, Madame Swartzout. But were you not also heard in that very same tavern, loudly insisting to anyone who will listen that?
Yeah, man, you gotta do it, and then I can have sex with his wife. And then we'll all be even. Yeah, that does sound a bit familiar, I suppose.
Make no mistake, madame et monsieur. I will solve this case as I solve every case. For I am the finest detective in the history of Burgundy. However, while I conduct my investigation, you too will be confined.
No! No, I'm innocent.
This sucks.
My only crime was loving too much.
Well, here we are in medieval jail.
Yep. I guess I let my medieval carnal lust get the better of me again.
I can't believe they've strapped me to an actual ball and chain. This is nothing like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I know, and, you know, this Poirot guy seems a little bit legit, but... I am worried that the Middle Ages didn't quite yet have the forensic technology necessary to solve murders.
Nah, man, they had it all figured out.
What?
You either pay a guy or God sorts it for you.
What?
Yeah. I guess to get into this and answer all these questions, we're going to have to podcast about it.
Good thing I brought my microphones.
I can't believe they let you bring that with you into the cell.
I think the medieval guards just didn't know what they were. I told them they were relics that that contained the bones of long dead saints of music and song.
The feast is all. Now brimming wine in lordly cup is seen to shine before each eager guest. And silence fills the crowded hall, as deep as when the herald's call thrills in the loyal breast.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, my accomplice.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Etc. You know, I'm trying to create a bit of mise-en-scene as we're in this jail cell.
And today we are coming at you from right out of the clink, talking about how medieval people solved murders. And, because, like, let's face it, you know, we all make mistakes. You get angry, you get talking to a guy, you get stabbing, and then, oh my god, all of a sudden there's blood on your hands. You drop the knife, you flee into the medieval alleyways, never to be seen again, right?
Well, no, because it turns out there were lots of different ways to solve murders in the Middle Ages, and we're going to talk about them. And we're also going to, I'd say, limit this conversation mostly to England, because A, there's a lot to talk about with England, and B, we couldn't find very good sources for the continent.
Yep, that's right. I guess it's no surprise that we would have the easiest time finding common law sources. Ba-dumps.
Oh.
First things first, I mean, we have lots of actual records of how medieval murder investigations went down, don't we? I think you found a few for us.
Yes, at least for the late Middle Ages, sorry. One of the great resources that we have for understanding medieval murders is the University of Cambridge's Medieval Murder Maps resource, which maps out basically a lot of murders that happened in London, York, and Oxford in the late Middle Ages. Now, this list is not comprehensive. It's based on coroner's records, which we'll get into quite a bit later. But it does provide a lot of flavor and a lot of color for what kinds of murders were being committed in these cities in the 14th century. So, and I want to give you a few of these examples so you can kind of understand what kinds of crimes we're talking about. And before I get to them, I do want you to know that I did cherry-pick the most interesting, because a lot of these murders in this record were just two guys were on the street, and then they had an argument about something interminable, and then one of the magians pulled a knife and stabbed the guy, and then he ran off, and then they caught him. And it's just that, forever. So I've picked some funnier ones. So this first one is headed, Vicious Attack for Dropping Eel Skins Outside of Shop.
That sounds eely bad.
Oh, wah, wah, wah. Sorry, I just have a button on my desk.
Wow, someone must have gotten hurt eelings.
Incredible. Can you go for the three?
Ooh, girl. Stab me like a merchant of eels.
Yes. So, on the 15th of August, 1326, the coroner and sheriffs of London were informed that Roger Stewart of Hampton lay dead of unnatural causes in the High Street of Cheap in the ward of Candlewick Street. And according to the coroner's records, which was compiled after the attack, basically, so Roger was walking along Cordwainer Street with a big bucket of eels that he wanted to sell, and he just threw some eel skins down onto the street opposite shops owned by Simon de Peckham and John de Caslingby. Now, Richard, John's apprentice, came up to him and said, "Hey man, what the fuck?" And they had an argument. And so Richard came out of the shop and slapped him with the palm of his hand in the face before going back to work. Which I love as a detail.
Yeah.
Well, if that resolved that situation. Simon de Peckham then followed Roger as far as the churchyard of St. Mary le Bow and hit him on the head over his left ear so that he fell to the ground and then kicked him. Roger got up with difficulty and was going towards Cheap when he fell down and immediately died. So Simon and Richard, upon hearing of the death, took refuge in the church of St. Mary le Bow, and Richard got arrested eventually. Just don't, like, deface people's businesses. Another one that caught my eye is Fishmonger Stabbed to Death by His Mistress.
Yes!
So, on the 28th of October, 1336, the coroner and sheriffs of London were informed that William Myson, the fishmonger, lay dead of an unnatural death in a place rented in the parish of St. Catherine Coleman in the Aldgate Ward. According to the jury that was then convened, on the preceding Friday, after curfew, William Meissen was quarreling with Isabella Heron, his mistress, and Isabella struck William above the left breast with a knife, inflicting a mortal wound of which William died on Tuesday. Inflicting a mortal wound which he died from. Again, there's too much flavor of feasts. It's always, all these are couched in terms of, this was in between these two feasts.
Yeah, well, that's what they did.
So yeah, women, can't trust it, May. Sometimes they'll just stab you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's tough work being a fishmonger these days.
All right, I've got a couple more that I think are fun.
Yeah.
You want to go murder committed by men who break into a prison?
Yeah, hit us with it.
Yes, so Nicholas, on the 2nd of June 1325, Nicholas Mill, the gatekeeper of Newgate Prison, was found dead on the high street outside of Newgate Prison. And what happened was, Adam Cheddesley, nicknamed Clitheroe, don't laugh at that.
Sorry.
You're an adult woman. That's not, don't laugh at it.
No, it's just funny that he has a nickname that's mentioned. It's recorded. Not about the specific nickname. It's just funny that he has it and it's recorded.
John Burrell, Henry of Melbourne, and Robert of Silverstone broke into Newgate Prison, and when there, Adam killed Nicholas with a long, broad knife. Apparently the records do say that they were aided and abetted by two women. So like, ooh, once again,
babes
be dangerous.
Yeah.
The most dangerous animal on the planet Earth, a woman.
The female of the species, yes, is more deadly than the male.
Absolutely.
I think Rudyard Kipling said that, and he's never been wrong about anything.
joke, don't write in. Last one that I've got is the murder of Thomas the Baker, who was formerly servant to Robert the Head Baker. So on the 11th of May, 1316, Thomas the Baker was found dead in the common sewer below the city wall in Cripplegate. Apparently, at curfew on the previous Sunday, Thomas had gone to his employer Robert's house in St. Albans Parish and had demanded wages for his period of employment, and then Robert had refused to pay him. And then, so when Thomas repeated his demand, Robert still refused to pay, so Thomas continued to repeat his demand as he followed Robert up the staircase to the sitting room. Robert then turned on Thomas and thrust him violently downstairs. When Thomas fell to the ground, he broke his neck and died. During the night, John of Shrewsbury, John of Oxford, and Thomas of Reigate, who were Robert's servants at the time, took Thomas Baker's body to the sewer where it lay until the Tuesday. Which is, again, this is a very... That's a very, like... murder mystery of the week thing to happen.
Oh yeah.
Employment dispute leads to man getting pushed downstairs.
No, definitely.
So that's just a flavor of the kinds of murders that you could have in medieval London. And I do encourage people to go out and have a look at the medieval murder maps because there's lots of fun stuff in there. And yes, gals were doing it too.
Yeah.
Girl power.
Girls just want to have fun.
But it begs the question. Okay, so a murder's been committed. A body's been discovered. How do you actually then investigate that murder and figure out who should be blamed and what should happen to them?
Would it surprise you if I said it depends?
It do depend, though.
Yes, because we see a huge variation of different ways that people went about this across the Middle Ages, even within England, across different localities and times. It really could vary. Case to case, honestly, it could vary. And so we are going to be going through and pulling out some common threads, as well as giving you some of our favorite and most colorful examples, as we already have. And I think there's no better place to start than at the beginning, relatively speaking, in the early Middle Ages, in the Anglo-Saxon period.
Yes. How do Anglo-Saxons investigate and prosecute crime?
Well, there are a lot of oaths.
They love oaths.
Oaths are the bread and butter of Anglo-Saxon society. It's great. So, Anglo-Saxons, and you will, if you've listened to our episode on Vikings in the Arctic, then you'll notice quite a few things in common between Anglo-Saxon laws and legal systems and Norse ones, because I think there are a lot of common sort of themes underpinning, in general, Northern Germanic legal systems.
Oh, yeah.
And so one of these is the fact that the courts basically are on these fixed schedules. They don't meet that often. And if you have a problem that you want to raise, you're going to have to wait until the courts meet again. So your local court might meet like once a month, but then like your county court probably meets quarterly. And your royal court probably meets about once a year. And so it's your responsibility, basically, to bring any complaints or accusations that you might have to the appropriate court. So something really severe, like a murder case, you're probably going to want to bring to your county or royal court. But bring someone to court, you can indeed. So if you accuse someone of a crime, they can be summoned to court. They are legally required to appear. And then you can basically state your accusation. There are formulas that are given in the Anglo-Saxon laws for, you know, saying what you're accusing this person of. And then they will be given an opportunity to deny the crime. So after that, the fun begins. So you guys basically get a chance to argue your cases. You can bring evidence, you can make arguments, you can bring witnesses. And what exactly you are bringing to court to try to convince them? Well, yeah, that can depend quite a bit on the severity of the crime, for instance, what exactly has been committed. But in general, the bread and butter of Anglo, the you know, what Anglo-Saxon society is made of is oaths. And what we see in the courts, especially in the early Middle Ages, although also throughout all of the Middle Ages, to be honest, is the importance of having people who can stand by you and the importance of social clout. One of the important principles of this, of course, is the fact that in certain cases, you can surrender all of your social status by committing a crime, and this makes you someone who it is permissible to kill, basically. So for instance, if you are stealing or you are forcing yourself upon someone's sister, wife, mother, or daughter, they can kill you. If you are fighting under the directions of your lord, then you are allowed to kill people. If your lord tells you to, you can't be held responsible. And if it's found to be unlawful, then your lord can often be held responsible, not you. You were just following orders.
Yeesh.
And you can also kill someone if they are attacking one of your associates or family members. So there is a lot of basically legal killing going on. Again, you might remember this from when we talked about the blood feuds that Eric the Red and his family were involved in. There was a lot of killing back and forth, as you might recall, and there was not a lot of legal intervention.
It eventually just got to the point where everybody was like, okay, fine, just fuck off, go away.
Yeah, so there could be these really extensive, drawn-out blood feuds, especially earlier on in the Middle Ages, that could just be completely destructive. Whole families could be wiped out. And it was really a matter of honor. If someone close to you was killed, then it was your obligation to restore the honor that their killers had taken from you, their relative, by exacting revenge. And so pretty early on in the Middle Ages, we see court systems and rules in place that can try to help mitigate this constant bloodshed. And so one of the ways that this was done was the Wehrgeld, which literally translates to man money. So that's right, you're a man, you're worth money. There is a numerical value on your life.
That's so bleak.
Well, do you know what your Wehrgeld is based on?
Well, it's based on your social status. So if you're a churl, you're going to be worth significantly less, which is just like a normal guy, lowest kind of social standing. You're going to be worth much less than a thane, which is, you know, a local noble.
Yeah, so your Wehrgeld in general is based on how much land you own. Mm-hmm. So you can totally bump up your Wehrgelds by acquiring a bit more land. But yeah, these two things are very deeply interlinked. In fact,
it's nice to know that the lives of landlords are worth more.
Yes, in Anglo-Saxon England, yes. In fact, a lot of Anglo-Saxon law codes refer to men in terms of their Wehrgelds. So for instance, in the laws of Alfred the Great in the late 9th century, they refer to 1,200 men, which are men whose wehrgeld is 1,200 shillings. That's the thanes, the nobles. And then they refer to 200 men. That's the regular guys, the churls. They're worth 200 shillings.
Again, this is bleak.
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's Anglo-Saxon England. It's not a walk in the park. Right, so this was money that someone who killed you could be demanded to pay to your friends and family, essentially. And so if someone was found to be guilty of a crime, then they could avoid any other punishment by paying this sum. So in this way, officials could try to avoid this constant back and forth, eye for an eye, you know, guy for a guy type of thinking. I should mention, by the way, a shilling was commonly defined by the Anglo-Saxons themselves as the value of a sheep or sometimes a cow. So that's you're nice. Still worth 200 sheep, which is a lot of sheep. If you consider like the price of wool or like cows, if you consider the price of like beef and milk and cheese and whatnot, like...
Yeah, okay.
You're a valuable guy. And I think this is...
200 sheep. I can live with that.
I think this is really something that's important to draw out, is that it's not necessarily... The system, I think, was not constructed with the goal necessarily of, you know, trading people's lives like they're, you know, game tokens. It really was a system that was trying to create an alternative form of releasing or relaxing community tensions. Interestingly, your own wehrgeld could also be a value that you were commanded to pay if you were found guilty of a crime, even if it was not something like murder. Say you stole somebody's sheep. Well, that's a pretty big deal. That guy needed those sheep to live. And so you could be commanded to pay him your own wehrgeld in order to be absolved of that crime.
Which I imagine would be prohibitive. Not many people have 200 sheep.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So it is, yeah, it is quite a bit of money. So for instance, the late 7th century laws of King Ina, I think that's pronounced, say, if a thief is captured in the act of thieving, let him suffer death or redeem his life through payment of his wehrgeld. And I think this is the one of the most important things to take away from this. Your wehrgeld was also used as a way of establishing the value of your testimony in court. So just like how a thane's wehrgeld is 6 times that of a churl, a noble is 6 times as valuable as a common man, a noble's oath was 6 times more valuable than that of a common man. And so you would need 6 common men to swear by you in court. To give yourself, you know, basically a testimony that was equivalent in weight to that of one nobleman.
So essentially, a trial was like a really shit game of top trumps with 2 cards.
Well, yeah, I think more often what would happen was you might bring someone to court, say, for stealing from you. Both sides would be given the opportunity to make their case. Maybe one side would be, you know, make a really compelling testimony or have some really compelling piece of evidence. And so it would be possible to solve court cases without having to invoke this system of oaths.
Get the abacus out.
Yeah, whatsoever. But absolutely, in cases when there, you know, weren't any witnesses to the crime and there couldn't be any conclusion drawn any other way, yeah, they would basically, what would happen is the courts would set, or the law codes would set, a value of oath that was needed in order for one to absolve oneself of a specific crime. Worse crimes, you need higher value oaths, and it would be your job to basically go around your friends and ask them all to vouch for you. So,
I hate to ask this, but are you free on Saturday? I know. We were going to go.
Man, not again.
We were going to go down to the river. It was going to be a whole thing. But unfortunately, they do think that I cut a guy's head off. So I am going to need you to come in and tell them about how I gave a really good best man speech.
Oh, can't you just ask the Thane man? He's worth 6 of me.
You think the Thane will talk to me?
Yeah, to be fair, you are pretty lame. And crucially, you know, this is not people who are asked to swear that you are innocent. These are just people who are being asked to swear that you're a sound guy.
It's a character reference.
It is basically a character reference, yes. And so,
which we never use in court today.
And so, yeah, the laws of Ina, the same laws as before, specify one accused of belonging to a band of thieves shall clear himself through an oath worth 120 hides, or pay an equal amount as compensation. So, this is when we get out the abacus for sure, because hide is like a unit of land, and so we have to convert between hides and weregelds, basically.
Oh, God.
But the long and short of it is, a thane's word would be worth 60 hides, whereas a churl's is only worth 10. So if you are accused of belonging to a band of thieves, and there's, it seems like there's pretty good evidence to prove that that might be true, well, lucky you, you can still clear your name by getting either 12 regular blokes or 2 really noble blokes to swear by you, or 6 regular guys and 1 noble bloke.
Just going down the pub and just being like, right, come with me.
Yeah, exactly. So as you can imagine, this system made it pretty easy to leverage social clout against people of a lower status than you. And that's not getting into women and slaves who had no weregeld and were basically treated as property by the law. Of course, that's not to say that you could just accuse anyone of anything willy-nilly. Again, like, you would probably be expected to provide some sort of evidence, or plausible, you know, explanation for why you were accusing this person.
Yeah, you couldn't just, like, spin out, like, Elon Musk and call a guy a pedophile and then just block anybody who's like, what did you mean by that?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And the, crucially, the people who would be the jurors in your case would generally be your local thanes. And so these would be local nobles, basically, who would be deliberating. And so they would probably have a good sense if someone who had absolutely no run-ins with the law and seemed, you know, squeaky clean was being accused of something by, you know, a local low-life criminal, they would probably throw the case out, even if the low-life criminal had a higher social status. But you can also imagine in that case how a lot of soft power came into play when assessing whether a case would even be heard, or whether anyone's evidence or witnesses would be heard.
Which I think speaks to an important point about why, you know, probably why this system worked the way that it did for so long, which is that realistically, in these kinds of trials, pretty much everybody knows each other, and because it's a small community, like the Anglo-Saxon village hamlets are not big. It's like a couple hundred people at most, right? And what that also means is that these are communities that have to, in order to function at all, have to have a high level of social trust, right? Because you're in this incredibly precarious situation. In 6 months, you could all die of starvation through just a roll of the dice, right? You need to be able to stick together, and you need to be able to trust people to be able to give their oaths, you know, reliably. Because, like, yeah, okay, great. So let's say that somebody kills somebody, and then there's a conspiracy to everybody swears an oath, and then nothing gets done about it, right? Unfortunately, there's nothing you can do about that, even if that wasn't how the legal system worked. Because if everybody in a community of any social standing is like, no, we're not doing anything about this, you're fucked in a community like that. Because again, you can't swim against that tide.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just formalizing the way that those social relationships already worked.
Yeah, and there were various degrees of formalization when it came to how people with, you know, either blood, relative, or personal ties stood by each other, because you had a pretty heavily entrenched sense of collective responsibility in Anglo-Saxon society and law. So these existed in various forms, in varying degrees of formality. So the simplest thing, the simplest example would be your immediate family. Say you kill someone and you can't pay up the weregelds. maybe your, you know, the local sheriffs could go knocking on your mom and dad's door and your sister's door and your children's door and ask them to all pitch in a little bit, or else they could be held just as responsible as you. But especially later on in Anglo-Saxon England, this was more and more formalized in the form of groups. For example, the tithings, who are groups of 10 men who all live near each other. Basically, think of it as you and your 10 or your 9 closest land-owning neighbors. And they had a legally defined sense of, or duty of, common responsibility and shared responsibility for each other. So, for instance, if one of the guys in your tithing killed someone and skipped town, they could all be held responsible for the crime, unless they went and got you back. So you have this whole notion of collective responsibility as something that is used both to help you and to keep you in line. So if, for instance, you're killed, it's your family or your tithing or some other social group who can be counted on to gather evidence and bring it to court and pursue that case and go around to your, you know, killer's friends and family's houses and get that weregeld out of them. But at the same time, if you killed someone, they're probably the people who are going to come track you down and find you, because they don't want to be held responsible. Of course, you know, you hope that as an Anglo-Saxon, imagine that you are an Anglo-Saxon for a second, close your eyes, you're standing in your wheat fields.
Right, this is a lovely wheat field.
You know, there's not a lick of French vocabulary in your brain.
Ooh-ar.
You know, I think that one of the ways in which this exerted control over Anglo-Saxon society was, you know, just the fact that you wouldn't want to let your buddies down necessarily. You didn't really want to be the guy who was asking your 9 mates to all pitch in because you killed a guy and now you all collectively owe his mom 200 sheep, you know? And so it also created a sense of personal responsibility.
Because that guy might experience a hunting accident later in the year.
Yes, yes, exactly. Off too many people. And, you know, if he's turned all of his tithing against him, then who's going to bring that one to court? Nobody.
Well, and this, I think, gets to the heart of something that's really important about justice in this early medieval period, which is that the law doesn't really have, like, the law is not something that can be really imposed on communities externally. There's no, like, the central royal state, such as it existed in, you know, early medieval England, doesn't really have, like, you know, there are sheriffs, but, like, that's not the equivalent to, you know, the local police force who can actually kind of come round your house and fucking arrest you. Like, this is dependent on people agreeing, all right, this guy's crook, let's do him in, basically. And if you can't do that, there's no point having a fake law that's, you know, gathering dust in Colchester or whatever, saying that you have to do that. Mechanisms of coercion.
All right.
The long arm of the law.
Yes.
As you might call it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, again, I think that collective responsibility really is the theme here, and that doesn't go away completely, of course, later in the Middle Ages. But yeah, I think that it's important to get into your head this idea that a lot of law was oriented around at the time, which was that, you know, there were, you know, was that the law was a way of exacting justice and making sure that everyone had what was due to them. And that included things like human lives. And again, I don't think it's really fair to say, although this does seem like a connotation, that, you know, they were putting a value on a human life, because, I mean, what does that even mean in a philosophical sense? But if you consider a legal system in which, you know, there isn't really a external impetus to prosecute criminals, there is no obligation to just go, you know, punish these things for their own sake. And there, you know, are these, there is always this looming possibility of even a small crime or a small argument spiraling into this incredibly destructive multi-generational type of conflict. Then, yeah, this idea that you know, you and your community could be held responsible to cough up, basically, in order to keep somebody happy, in order to make good on, you know, a slight against someone's honor, a loss that they had suffered because of you, then, you know, I think that is, I think it does go a little bit deeper than just, you know, one man equals 200 sheep, two men equals 400 sheep, etc. And again, I think it is important to remember that this was not the only way of solving trials, and that things like, again, evidence and witnesses could be given. So I was reading about an example of cold hard evidence being given in an Anglo-Saxon court in the form of this letter called the Fonthill Letter. So this is a really great letter that was written to the king of England at the time. I think it was the English king, maybe it was a Kentish king specifically or something, but anyways, by some local noble, basically explaining all the ways in which this crazy, stupid guy, who he used to be mates with, had slighted him. And the crimes just go from bad to worse. The first one is, like, he stole a belt, and the last one is, like, he stole 700 cows.
Okay, which is quite a feat.
yeah, it's
unless you're doing
2,800 feet, I believe. The accuser of this letter, the guy who is accusing the other guy of the crime, talks about how this alleged criminal fled through a bramble bush at one point, and this letter was actually used as evidence in court because the criminal showed up to his trial with scratches all over his face.
That's so great.
And of course you could ask yourself, well, like, you know, how can it be proven that this, the reason why this criminal had scratches on his face was because of this exact situation described? Well, that's probably where caring more about the noble's word than the, you know, criminal's word comes into play. But again, they're all different pieces in the puzzle, and they're all different ways that could be used to help approach some kind of conclusion.
So these weren't the only kinds of trials that were happening in early medieval England. We also have, like, one of the, probably the most famous, I'd say, examples of medieval justice are trials by ordeal or trials by combat. So this is basically, you determine whether or not somebody is guilty of a crime by doing something to them, whether it's making them, you know, put their hand in boiling oil and, you know, seeing if the wound is infected, or, you know, witch dunking. I mean, not literally that, but that's the same sort of basic principle. Or you have a trial by combat by where two guys fight and the person who won wins the case, right? Now, these really throw people off because they are some basically Alice in Wonderland bullshit, essentially, to a modern reader. Because it's like, what on earth does whether or not your hand needs to get bandaged after putting it in boiling oil, what does that have to do with anything? Like, why does this physical process or the outcome of a fight determine, like, right from wrong? It's a very unsettling idea. All right? It's a, and, you know, it's explored in, famously, in Monty Python. You know, she's a witch. That sort of, you know, we've everybody's seen that movie. Yeah. Anyway, point being, and there's so many variations on this. So, like, having to pick up an object from boiling water, having to carry a piece of heated iron for nine feet, and, you know, seeing if it heals. And I think that there's a very, very important point to make when we are talking about the legitimacy and the sort of conceptual basis of these trials and what their internal logic, at least on paper, was, which is nobody who is conducting these trials literally thinks that the basic physical property or process that's happening here is the thing that establishes guilt or innocence. Guilty people float is not literally what's happening. The rationale for doing this is the assumption that, basically, that God will intercede in these conditions one way or another. So all the authorities basically need to do is set up the parameters of the test and God, who is both omnipotent and the source of all righteousness and justice, will provide an objective answer, right? Basically, deferring it up the chain.
Yeah, if I may interject briefly.
You may.
I think there's also, you know, a really important medieval kind of common, or perhaps even specifically Catholic cultural theme of flesh as being corruptible versus incorruptible. I mean, you might remember in our episode about the medieval cosmos, we talked about the nasty, corruptible, changeable sublunary sphere where we, the humans, live versus like the beautiful, perfect, you know, never changing, beautifully ordered superlunary sphere where God and the angels live and all the planets are, and it's way better up there. And there is kind of a common thread in medieval Christian thinking of a dichotomy of, like, you know, things that change and fester bad because they indicate inner, you know, internal or spiritual festering versus things that heal or things that stay the same, things that are not corruptible. Physically, those are good because they represent an incorruptible soul and an incorruptible spirit. And that, of course, comes back to the idea of intelligent creation, that God, you know, created things to fulfill a certain purpose, to look in particular a certain way that indicates their spiritual value or function. I mean, for instance, we have many different stories and hagiographies of saints which describe how after they died, their bodies were incorrupt. They did not rot or decay. And this is an indication of the spiritual purity of the saint. I should say we do actually have quite a few corpses of saints that have been declared by the Catholic Church as incorrupt. Most of them look pretty rough. They don't look great. Some of them, they've been like encased in wax to make them look normal again.
Which feels cheating to me.
It does a little bit. I mean, far be it from me to, you know, presume any sort of authority in those matters. but again, it's the underlying idea that matters. And so, yeah, I think this was such an important sort of underpinning of medieval thought.
Yeah, and it's important to draw out that theological reference point because this is a very religiosized process. So trials by ordeal were generally carried out by the church pretty much continually and by your local priest. And so generally before a trial by ordeal, the accused would be sanctified, so shaved, covered in holy water, named in prayers of benediction, etc., etc., etc. The whole thing is incredibly formalistic and it's all about sort of making this the most sanctified possible conditions, basically, laboratory conditions, essentially, for conducting this scientific test. And lots of people have pointed out that it's possible that the entire edifice of it, the entire process of, you know, covering, slathering people in holy oils, like making people think about God a whole awful lot, is designed to basically circumvent the whole question of whether or not somebody's guilty or innocent by making guilty people feel so guilty that they then confess. Because the fear of facing God's wrath and you know, being shown to be a liar and perjuring yourself essentially on a cosmic scale is pretty frightening and Lovecraftian. The other thing that's interesting about this is the acquittal rate of trials by ordeal. Because we have some data on how often people were actually condemned by a trial by ordeal. And I think that a lot of the time, when we think about trials by ordeal, we usually think about, you know, 17th century witch hunts. You basically think about it as like, you dunk this woman in the water, it's a death sentence either way, so like, you're fucked, essentially. But a medieval trial by ordeal, actually, most of the time you're going to get let off. I think we have data from the 13th century in the Hungarian sanctuary of Nagyvárad. Of the people who were tried by ordeal, 130 were shown to be innocent and only 78 were proved guilty. So that's around about 2-1. I like those odds.
Yeah, It's not too bad at all, actually.
Well, there's still like a 30% chance that you're about to die.
Well, you know, depends. Were they just deciding randomly? You know, were the outcomes truly random? I don't know, and I think it's a really good question. And of course, the mechanics of how these trials were carried out are often unrecorded.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is really, really important to stress that the fear of God and the fear of divine wrath and judgment was one of the, you know, was essentially what was used to create a sense of legitimacy in these trials. And so they aren't possible in the slightest without religion, in particular with medieval Christianity and the medieval Christian worldview. I think that being said, whether or not they were all sort of carried out on a by-the-books basis is probably an important question to ask ourselves as well.
Yeah, because there's a lot of ways you can swing a trial like this subtly. For example, if you're asking people to take an object out of a boiling pot, it is... nobody's got a thermometer.
Yes.
Nobody's going to be able to definitively prove whether or not the boiling pot has reached the sufficient temperature.
Yeah.
So if, for example, you put one less log on that fire, maybe somebody does get off.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a huge amount of leeway given to priests about how they are going to oversee those trials.
Yeah. And again, I'm not saying that all of these trials are basically like priests rigging it according to however they think it should go, but if you think back to when we talked about medieval witches, for instance, and we talked about examples of priests, for instance, invoking fear of God in order to get people to return stolen linens, you know, both the fear of God and the priests' social knowledge and their position within the community are important players in this situation. And you can imagine that both the trial itself and, you know, this lead-up time of purification and cleansing and prayer and fasting would possibly give the priest an opportunity to mediate with the accused and perhaps, you know, either use their knowledge of the community or of this person to try to exact a confession before it went to trial, or, you know, perhaps it would give them time to prepare to swing the outcome a little bit in the other direction if the priest thought this person was innocent.
And ironically, can I just say, you could argue that the thing that gives, that lets priests tip the scales a little bit is in fact this belief that God will intercede. Because,
yeah,
well, I'm gonna, you know, try and tip the scales for him. But if he's really guilty, then God would make that very clear.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, I'm a priest. I'm an agent of God.
Yeah.
God is telling me that this guy didn't do it. So, you know.
God, so much of God, especially medieval God, is vibes.
Yes, is vibes.
God is vibes.
Vibes that ultimately are picked up on by, like, your sleazy local priest who, like, goes out drinking and has sex with a nun every Friday night, you know?
Oh, what a life.
But he's like, listen, man, I can get you your stolen cow back. No problem. Like, it's my pleasure. He's not even going to charge you anything. So, yeah, again, you know, I think you can't separate out the religious and the... so to speak, although we don't like this word, secular threads from this type of trial. But I think that arguably it, in some cases, probably worked in quite a similar way to a more sort of by the books trial, in that it gave, you know, at least in the Middle Ages, in that it gave someone's peers, someone in a position of authority and knowledge of their community, an opportunity to mediate a you know, experience in which community tension within the community was released without the need for violence.
So, early Middle Ages, it's a lot of social, a lot of criminal investigations and trials are driven by social trust and also by the sort of overseeing role of the church in kind of determining what is right and what is true. Now, this whole system does get slightly holed beneath the waterline in 1215 at the Lateran Council, where the church essentially, among various other things that we won't get into, like being meaner to Jewish people, the church does... I know. The church does formally ban priests from officiating trials by ordeal.
Yeah, so it's worth saying this is just one of, like, the many councils that the church convenes over the course of the Middle Ages.
Oh my god, there's no way to even count them.
General problems, shall we say. Just, you know.
It's a real, like, it's like how in the US, like, you know, like, how they can't, like, pass any normal legislation. So they have to pass some, like, monstrous omnibus bill.
Yeah.
That's called, like, the Brittany Act, and it's got, like...
Brittany is short for, like, you know...
Building, repairing, infrastructure, technology.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, that's like 10% increase in CIA funding.
Yes, exactly.
Plus banning certain kinds of chemicals.
Exactly.
Plus reforming the Electoral Count Act.
Plus legalizing, like, a new kind of yellow dye that gives you hemorrhages.
So... what do you do when you when you can't sort of appeal directly to God to get a trial resolved? And
gotta appeal to some other guy.
Yeah. Well, essentially. So this is the point at which English law starts to hive off somewhat from the law that's practiced on the continent. So generally on the continent, what would happen is if a body was discovered or some crime was uncovered, an inquisitor would be appointed to interrogate witnesses and find a culprit, and then they would produce written testimony that we presented at a trial, and a sentence would be handed down by a professional judge. Now, we have some. I'm not going to dwell too much on this because we're trying to focus on England in this episode, but I did want to give you a little bit of flavor from Tancred of Bologna, who was a 13th century writer, who gave some advice about how a judge should conduct himself in a trial. The judge ought to interrogate the witness diligently about all things which have an effect on the case, through which he is better able to elicit the truth, and inquire prudently about each circumstance, namely regarding persons, place and time, sight, hearing, knowledge, or credulity, rumor and certainty, and have all reduced to writing. So this system was based on Roman law. And under Roman law, judges couldn't be accusers. So the accusation of a crime had to come from a member of a community who would not be named personally in the proceedings. And in a lot of cases, a rumor or insinuation of guilt was sufficient to start the inquisitorial process, which you could say was equivalent to essentially the threshold for an investigation to be triggered, but essentially probable cause. And in a lot of Italian cities, a way that you kind of keep this whole kind of structure afloat, where again you have an impartial judge, is to basically have witnesses testify to the judge that they know about. Oh, we only know about this case indirectly. We've heard of it from somebody else. Now, why am I dwelling on this so much? Well, I think it's important to note because this is an example of justice becoming impersonal. The whole premise of it being that there is somebody who is a state official. Who is very explicitly not connected to the case and not connected to the community, and that's the way that you're going to find a kind of objective find a fair outcome from the trial, which is pretty much an opposite of everything that we've set up to this point.
Yeah, because Anglo-Saxons would be like, well, yeah. If someone isn't intimately familiar with the community and doesn't have loads of buddies in the community, how could he possibly make a good decision about the goings-on of this community?
Yes, and in many ways, that Anglo-Saxon assumption also carried over into the way that English law worked in the late Middle Ages, because, of course, England was also, just like the continent and their inquisitions, England was also deprived of the ability to run trials by ordeal, and so they had to come up with something else, basically. So what they did was they moved to a system of juries. Now, there's a very, very important point to be made here about English juries. In a modern jury, knowing the parties or anything about the case before you go in is pretty much instantly disqualifying. You have to be impartial. You have to be a complete blank slate. In medieval England, it is the exact opposite. In a medieval English jury is essentially, let's get everybody who knows about the case together in a room, and then they'll hash it out.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this whole idea of oaths and character references and attestations carrying legal weight is really something that we still have mm-hmm. with us today. Although the process for choosing, say, a jury is quite different. And we do try to, in some ways, sort of, you know, consciously expunge that type of bias from legal proceedings. We also do put a lot of weight on someone being able to show up in court and say, yeah, he's my buddy, he's sound.
Yeah. Quick sidebar, by the way, about jury selection. Have I told you about the time that the Scottish court system, in the course of a year, tried to get me on a jury 6 times?
No.
And I foiled them every time. This is awesome. And I want to say this because it is a crime to falsify anything, to lie about your availability for a jury. I want to emphasize that I was not available and everything happened above the book. This is not a confession of a crime. So basically when I was writing my undergrad dissertation, I got a letter from the court basically saying, hey, can you come and be the juror? It doesn't say, can you come and be the juror? It says, you are doing this, get with the program.
Have you seen the 30 Rock episode where Jenna Maroney is starring on a show called The Rural Juror?
No, but I've seen a clip.
The Rural Juror.
The Rural Juror. Anyway, so I'm like, listen, man, I'm writing my dissertation. Here's a letter from my supervisor saying, please leave him alone. And they left me alone. But they sent me a very threatening letter afterwards saying, but you're going to be first on our list next time there's a crime in Glasgow.
You're next, son.
Anyway, so then, like, then, you know, 3 months later, I get another letter. And they're like, guess what? We got you again. Come to Brayhead Shopping Center.
Yes!
Because this was
during... Oh, that's so sick.
Because this was during COVID, and all the trials were happening virtually.
In cinemas.
So I was sitting there. Also, this was the day after the 2020 presidential election when nobody knew what the outcome was going to be. So I was like, going to... In this incredibly overpriced Uber... To Brayhead Shopping Center with this cloud of doom hanging over me. And then they stopped me at the door and say, oh yeah, actually we decided we don't need you anymore. Whoa. And then there were about 3 more different times that they tried to get me. One time I had to say, like, listen, I am going to America. Please leave me alone. It just went on and on and on and on. They kept trying to get me when I had holidays. And then eventually it stopped when I was like, listen, man, I live in England now. You're going to have to stop this.
Whoa.
But I am on the electoral roll in England, which means they will get me eventually. They're going to get you.
I'm not on the electoral roll.
They'll get you.
Well, I'll just say no. Are you obligated to do jury duty if you're not a citizen?
I actually don't know that.
Do non-citizens must jury duty?
Can you say that into the mic so people can hear the incredible sentence construction?
I just wrote into Google, do not citizens must jury duty, UK. Part of a jury of 12 people. Wow, just like the Middle Ages.
No, not like the Middle Ages. Oh, because the number of people in a jury... Thank you for that. The number of people in a jury was not fixed. It could be 12 people, but it also could be as many as 50 people, depending on the nature of the case and how many important sort of interested parties there were. And in order to be on the jury, you just had to be a man of good standing in the community. Emphasis on man. Women could not serve on a jury.
Women are never in good standing in their community.
Not in the Middle Ages, they're not. I refuse to be convicted by this strumpet.
her small woman brain is, you know, too...
too precious.
Too feeble to balance, you know, to juggle the notions of guilty and not guilty.
It's like that Onion quote about gays in the military.
They're too precious.
Exactly. They're too precious. Well, these women are too precious to be informed about horrible murders.
And sir, how many lives is the life of one Thane worth? 6.
Anyway, so the other important thing about medieval juries, or medieval English juries, is that they are self-informing. So the jury will gather the evidence about the case themselves instead of having it presented to them in a court by lawyers. Now, that doesn't mean that necessarily the jury was responsible for carrying out the investigatory work themselves. This job was left to an official called the coroner. Now, a coroner, as the name suggests, is a legal official, is a royal legal official, who is just responsible for, like, making sure that everything in their local area is sort of above board. It's really more of an auditor kind of role.
Yeah, in fact, I think the coroner was prohibited from giving any opinion whatsoever about, like, you know, the outcome of the case and any sort of culpability. He was legally only allowed to record what he perceived as facts.
Oh, yeah, because all the power of sort of, like, editorializing in these cases would sit with the jury, because it was very, very rare for actually witnesses to give testimony to a criminal investigation, which meant that it was basically the jury's gift, rather than, like, the judge would very rarely know anything about the case.
Yeah.
Whereas the jury was comprised exclusively of people who knew about the case.
Yep.
So, really, the judge doesn't have much power. The coroner is just a functionary who does the hard graft of investigating. The actual kind of decision-making sits with the jury, kind of as it does now, but with a much more active role.
Never in danger, quailed our fathers, free and undaunted, exalt our greener.
So, under that structure, how would a medieval murder investigation play out in late medieval England? Well, if a corpse was discovered under suspicious circumstances, then the townspeople of wherever this corpse was had a legal obligation to notify the coroner and sheriff of the body, and they would then convene a jury. Now, the first step would usually be the coroner and the jury examining the body externally to identify, measure wounds, measure basically any damage to the tissue. Interestingly, in medieval England, very, very few autopsies, unlike on the continent. And I've heard it said that the reason for this is that the Anglo-Saxon culture had a slightly different kind of perception of the relationship between the body and the soul. So the soul left the body slowly after death, and so you didn't want to, like, mess too much around with a corpse, because you might mess up that process. But again, I think that's somewhat speculative. It's just an interesting idea. Now, when you're examining the body, like in modern crimes, it can sometimes be hard to tell what the cause of death is. So, for example, the Oxford baker William de Bufford died of his stab wounds 17 days after two students attacked him outside of his house. And the coroner had to basically figure out, like, well, what was the actual cause of death here? Because you got two assailants. What wound killed him? And the coroner wrote that he had one wound on his left shoulder with a sword. It was 6 inches long and 2 inches deep, but it was not mortal. Also, he had another wound on his left side, which was mortal. 1 inch long, 1/2 inch broad, and 2 inches deep. So essentially, you have to look at the body and just kind of vibe out through your own kind of knowledge of human anatomy, which wound killed him. So once you've kind of looked at the body, the coroner would then essentially go around talking to all the people connected with the case and connected with the parties, and kind of establish a sequence of events, right? Again, as we talked about before, the coroner's role is not to opine on what happened, but just to establish what we know to be true. So, for example, we have 13th century treatises on how a coroner should go about with this work and like what kind of questions they should ask. And this text tells us that a coroner should inquire into whether the felony was committed in or out of a house, or whether in a tavern, or at a wrestling match, or another meeting. The two kinds of meetings that there are, you know. Wrestling matches and other. Then let it be inquired who were present at the fact, small, great and small, male and female, and who are guilty of the fact, and who of aid, or of force, or of commandment, or consent, or of knowingly receiving such felons. And further, he must inquire on the manner of the killing, and with what weapon, and of all these circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, like, medieval cities are smaller than modern cities, on average, but I think one sense that you get from reading through records of all of these cases is that most of them do have witnesses. There's very, very few cases that involve people where the victim or the killer cannot be identified. There are, like, the occasional case that's like, we pulled this body out of the river, and when we asked around, some people said they, you know, saw this guy fall in the river. So, you know, there is an element of having to take people's word for it, of course, but I think one of the things that people tend to forget about, or not give enough weight to when thinking about this, is that it's in a place where community and kinship ties are so important and so strong, and people in a neighborhood or a community probably all know each other quite well, even in a bigger city like London. If someone dies, like, your neighbors are probably going to have a pretty good chance of who did it.
Well, I think that I'm going to slightly disagree with you here, in that, or not even disagree with you, but I think draw out an important subtle difference about medieval city life versus medieval village life. Medieval cities had a lot of population churn, right? They were constantly, their populations were constantly being ravished by disease and then replenished by people coming from outside of the city, from the interior, from the exterior, basically, to kind of, to replenish the population, do all the jobs they need doing, right? And that means that although you will know who your neighbors are, you probably don't know them in the sense that you know your neighbors in an isolated rural village, right? You don't necessarily have ties to them. You don't necessarily have extra legal obligations, right? And these kinds of extra legal obligations, which is to say, like, your bonds of kinship and the fact that you're all in this sort of shared destiny together, and you probably are fucking their cousin as well on the side. Like, these are the things that make a legal system based on oaths and social trust work. But I do think that there is something to the fact that in Western Europe, you do see, over the course of the Middle Ages, increasing urbanization and increasingly people moving around to different parts of countries, right? And at the same time, in the late Middle Ages, you are seeing, as we've kind of been teasing out here, the establishment of a more professionalized, more rules-based idea of the law, an idea of law and order and public good.
And in particular as well, an idea that there might exist like a separate class of people whose job is to know and apply those rules.
Yes.
Not just like your mate.
It's an increasingly bureaucratic system which requires professional bureaucrats. And there's a phrase actually that Olivia used before we started recording that I think actually really, really sums up this transition really, really well, which is the idea that law becomes more idealistic. It becomes more of an abstract concept that is then applied to you by an external force. You know, this is... To get wanky and pretentious for a second here, this is the first kind of parts of what Thomas Hobbes will go on and call the Leviathan.
Yeah.
The entity of the state that, yes, is comprised of all of your fellow citizens, but also exists independently of any one of them and can crush them like a bug.
Yeah.
based on its own internal logics of right and wrong. And so this is a huge step change. And I don't want to overstate, like, of course, it's all obviously based on, implicitly, it still is based on social knowledge and these kind of extra legal factors, because you still have self-reporting juries. You still have juries that are comprised of the people who already have the most social knowledge. So I'm not going to stand here and say that the late medieval English legal system is somehow this super modern kind of abstracted thing that's completely independent of social knowledge, but it is different.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. And I think, you know, I think we also have sources that are somewhat biased, because we do just have a lot more sources for mm-hmm. London in particular, and for smaller cities to a lesser extent.
Yeah.
It's
not a coincidence that London, York, and Oxford are the cities that are on the medieval murder map, and they're also just three of the biggest cities.
Yeah, exactly. And they're also, you know, by and large, three fairly transient places. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if I could opine about York, but London is obviously the capital, and Oxford is where all the students are coming and going. So.
But students never commit any crime in the Middle Ages.
Yep. That's true. I'm Weird Medieval, guys, and I endorse this message.
That's a hashtag weird medieval fact.
I mean, I was a student, and I never committed a single crime, except stealing flower pots and pint glasses.
Shut up! We were just gonna leave that silence in.
But yeah, as well, it's, I think, you know, I mean, I keep saying this because I love the phrase, but it's also like the long arm of the law. It's the ability of the legal system to reach into your private life, whether you like it or not. And the idea of, you know, the law is something that exists independently of you and can be applied to you. And the idea of a crime, not just as something that can happen to you, but as something that is independently bad,
mm-hmm.
you know, from like a philosophical standpoint, yeah. and has a deleterious effect on society. So, despite the fact that the Lateran Council of 1215 made it no longer an option for priests to conduct these trials by ordeal, you know, plunge your hand into a cauldron of boiling water and, hey, let's just see what happens, that didn't completely write churches out of the legal process.
Yeah, because a lot of these coroner's roles, which is where we get these accounts of medieval murders, a lot of them end with, and then the assailants fled into a church.
Yeah, so I don't know if you've picked up on that, but that is a common theme. It's an incredibly common theme if you read any medieval coroner's roles or records. Most of them involve some variation on that. So if you committed a crime in the Middle Ages, you would probably be making an all-out dash for the nearest church, because there was generally an understanding, and this was enshrined in law, that you could not be punished for a crime if you were in a church. Now, that sounds a little bit sort of too permissive, doesn't it? I mean, it has the same feeling of, like, you know, if someone dies during the exam, we all get an A, right? It does. It really feels like yeah. that. And it's not, I will say, it's not quite that straightforward. So let's look into that a little bit more. But I think this is something that is a lot of people don't know about. And it was a massive part of the legal system. And crucially, and I will elaborate on this more later, it's not just a weird fluke or like a vestigial, irrational part of an antiquated legal system. I think this was a really important, almost, I think of it as like a pressure gasket for the legal system, in that it gave a way to, again, like a lot of these other things we've discussed, Anglo-Saxon oaths and trials by ordeal, it gave a route for nonviolent resolution. This is, one of my favorite medieval phenomena. So, in general, customs varied in England and in Europe, although this was generally a thing in all of Europe throughout the Middle Ages and even a bit after. But the general idea is, if you can make it to the church before they can get you, then you are basically immune from any immediate arrests or threats of punishment. So there were various sort of customs. In some churches, you had to get to the nave or the sanctuary or the altar, or ring a specific bell. The general idea was that people could not punish you within the church and they could not remove you from it. So that didn't mean that you could stay in the church forever. You probably wouldn't want to stay in the church forever. The church might not want you there forever.
Be a bit awkward on Sunday.
Definitely. But it did mean that the church had a general duty to receive and protect fugitives, at least initially, regardless of whether they were considered to be guilty. And generally, the local authorities were responsible for guarding the church and assuring that you couldn't leave, so they could be held responsible if you managed to escape. And actually, breaking these laws and customs of church sanctuary could confer a much harsher punishment than whatever was due to the person who you were trying to get at.
I mean, it got Robert Bruce excommunicated.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so we have records, for instance, this is just one example from Hexham Abbey in England, that anyone who killed or removed a fugitive would owe a fine of £96, which was a small fortune in the Middle Ages. They also had a specific carved stone chair, apparently several abbeys had these, called the frith stool, or in modern English, the peace chair. And if a fugitive made it to the frith stool, then anyone who violated their sanctuary right would be punished with death. So if you make it to the special safety chair, then nobody can touch you or else they'll get killed. So that's pretty crazy. And churches did take this duty quite seriously. We have a lot of examples of them pretty zealously defending fugitives, even when secular authorities or angry mobs came to try to drag people out of the church and exact justice. So there was a great example I read about from Canterbury in 1426. A young goldsmith who was apparently from overseas claimed sanctuary in Christchurch, and the local bailiffs, who possibly were upset about having been slighted or shorted on some sort of taxes, or payments they were owed, assembled an angry mob of local people and stormed into the church during communion, during mass on a Sunday.
Scandalous.
Super, super naughty.
Scandalous.
Tried to drag this guy out. And there's a description of this, like, you know, young criminal goldsmith, like, clinging to the tomb of the archbishop as they try to, like, drag him out.
By and his feet.
Yeah. And the monks, like, rallying the parishioners, you know, to rise from the pews and, like, fight off the bailiffs and this local mob. And apparently they were successful in doing so. And Wow. There are quite a few examples of clergy doing this. They would go to war to defend this right to sanctuary. So there was often, however, a limit on the amount of time for which you could claim sanctuary, especially in England. For very bad crimes, it might just be 3 days. Often the limit was 40 days. And after that, then you would have to leave and you would be offered generally a choice of either taking your chances with whatever the normal proceedings for a jury trial would be, or whatever the normal trial would be, or what is called abjuring the realm, i.e. exile. So you could leave England. They would book you a one-way ticket on a boat to France or Sweden or wherever.
France, the Australia of its day.
Yeah, I mean, basically. But you can imagine, you know, this might still have been a preferable option, especially if you were quite conspicuously guilty. But oftentimes taking that option involved confessing to the crime. And so this might also put you in a bit of an awkward position in some authorities where they had more resources and slightly more capacity. They might be able to escort you to the port, actually put you on the boat. But, you know, if you're in, like, the middle of England, if you're in, like, Rutland or Northamptonshire or whatever, like, they might just be walking you to the border of the county and saying, well, goodbye, go get on that boat, man. Okay, you're required to. And then who knows what would happen after that. So there's lots of records of people taking this option of exile. And then, you know, obviously, as soon as they're out of sight, basically going off to somewhere in England and trying to start their lives anew, or even just like coming right back home, which often would lead to all sorts of further difficulty. So not always a great option. And of course, there was always the possibility that if you were being forced to abjure the realm because you had committed a murder, maybe the kin of the people of the person you had murdered might make it their duty to see that you safely get on that ship, or perhaps that you never get on that ship as soon as they're out of the local authority area. And in this case, if you've already surrendered all of your possessions to the crown, as you'd be required to do, and agreed to basically leave and never come back, well, who's really to say whether anyone would go looking for you or find your body? So, again, not always a great option. And so we also have lots of examples of people escaping from churches while they're claiming this sanctuary right. We also have some great examples. There's a lot of, but again, these customs weren't the same everywhere. There were a lot of differences in how they were applied. There's a lot of really great particular cases. There's several cases, actually, of people being tried, found guilty, and hanged for crimes, and then their bodies being brought to the local church for burial. And once they're in the church, it's found that they weren't actually fully killed by the hanging. And at that point, like, for some reason, somehow the church's, like, sanctuary status kicks in. And they're often given either, like, you know, a bit of respite or often a royal pardon as well.
See, this is the point at which I start. The trial by ordeal kind of conspiracy brain does kick in. And you think, I wonder if you could. I do wonder if that what that situation was arranged.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely, because you know the letters from the king that offer the royal pardon often say, "Well, this was the intercession of God." So yeah, you do have to wonder. But again, I think this is interesting because it shows a very humane side of the church and an ability for clergy to act as, again, I don't know, I think that's like the best way I can put it is as a sort of pressure gasket, a way of, you know, if not sort of finding a perfect solution to these conflicts, then at least giving some time for maybe tempers to settle down and providing a second option for people to, you know, non-violently solve a conflict. I'll just finish off this little section with another mention of one of my of an example that really struck me, which came in 13th century Devonshire. There was a church which had been giving sanctuary to a man for 8.5 years. So he'd been staying in this church without leaving for 8.5 years.
Truly the Julian Assange of his day.
Well, so he was a man who had been involved in someone else's death, but he was also deaf and mute.
Oh.
And so I think it's a really particular case, not just because of the amount of time for which the church allowed him to stay, but also the fact that, you know, he was allowed to stay for that long indicates that, you know, people in the Middle Ages did have an idea of criminal culpability as something that might be lessened under extenuating circumstances. So clearly people saw this man's deafness and muteness and, you know, perhaps any other conditions that were associated with that as something that lessened his criminal culpability and made him entitled to safety, despite the fact that it seemed to be accepted that he had been involved in this killing. And so in 1232, King Henry III actually issued permission to the local abbot to move this man out of the church and into more proper lodgings in the abbey and to keep him fed and housed for the rest of this accused man's life, provided that he stayed within the boundaries of the abbey. And so, again, I think this also shows the medieval church as an apparatus that can step in where there aren't sort of explicit legal provisions for every single case, but there is maybe a gray area where A solution needs to be found, but perhaps it's not one where the solution is violence or, you know, forceful extraction of some sort of punishment or recompense.
Yeah, I think that what we can learn from this whole saga is kind of the role of law and what law is and what law enforcement and criminal culpability are socially, they're all socially contingent. And one of the things that's interesting about the Middle Ages, even again, if we're just restricting ourselves to England, is how much flexibility there is to bend, as it were, to bend the law to the social conditions, much, much more so than there perhaps is now. Although I would say that you do definitely see a trend over the course of the Middle Ages towards a system that looks more and more like modern English common law, and is more bureaucratic, in which bureaucrats have an explicit defined role, in which power is more explicitly vested in the external force of law enforcement. Not that there is a police force, obviously, but the idea that there is some kind of external force that's acting on the people who are living in a given kingdom. And of course, you know, that is the growing force and the growing power of the state as an abstract concept, rather than just like a bunch of relationships. Because of course, what is the definition generally accepted of a modern state? It is the state. The state is the institution that has the monopoly on, say it with me, everyone, the legitimate use of force.
Yes, it's all about coercion.
Uh-huh.
And I think you see a really interesting, you know, and arguably quite subtle transition, not necessarily a drastic one, over the course of the Middle Ages from that from that Anglo-Saxon period onwards, where, you know, coercion switches or shifts slightly from being the obligation of your community, or maybe even more properly kind of an emergent property of living within a community, mm-hmm. to being an external force which is applied upon you by the state.
Alors, madame et monsieur, accept my most sincere apologies for your confinement over the past 2 hours. The investigation into this murder has concluded, and the answer was inevitable. Was it the vengeful, wronged, cuckolded husband? No. Was it his overenthusiastic, overly protective friend? No. It was society.
Wait, what?
Wait, what?
Like it was all, it was both of us? It was everyone?
No, it was society.
Is this like a murder on the Orient Express type thing?
No, society.
But like, The bloody ham hock is lying right there. Someone's hand must have picked it up and clubbed him with it. It's like, who was the specific person to whom we can attach criminal culpability, man?
The culprit was nothing less than the Leviathan himself. You know the Leviathan is not like a real guy.
That was a metaphor.
It's an elaborate metaphor. Do you think there's a guy, a giant guy the size of a mountain, who's wears a shirt made out of human faces? That's what the cover of that book is.
Yeah, I know it's... I mean, I thought he was just like an agglomeration of people.
Yeah, again, I thought it was a metaphor.
Hello. Well, we will never know for sure.
Like, have you seen the Leviathan Man? Is he out there? Like, can we talk to him? Can we put him in jail?
Oh, he's already left. This is brilliant.
Oh, man.
You know, I've still got this ball and chain.
Waffle-eating bastard.
I never trusted the Burgundians. Not after what they did to Joan. All right. You start gnawing on this metal chain, and we'll be home in no time.
And, like, listen, man, you know, if you want to get rid of your ball and chain, like, you can send it around to my house. I'll make sure she has a good time. She'll never want to go back.
Father of mercy, when the day is dawning, then I will pay my vows to thee.
Well, that's just about going to do us for this episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. Before we wrap it up, just a quick programming note. You may notice that this episode came out on a Monday. All episodes will be coming out on a Monday, because we kind of just started releasing episodes on Fridays without really thinking about the fact that, for personal reasons, it was a huge pain in the ass.
Yeah, I mean, we started this podcast when I had a job which I was not very emotionally invested in, a 9-to-5, and I remember really distinctly, like, being on my way to work at the office that none of my coworkers would come into. They would all work from home, and like stopping.
That's a little clue as to what that employer was.
Woohoo! And like stopping in the park for like an hour while like, you know, I should have been on the clock to like finish editing this podcast while like sitting on a park bench on the banks of the Thames.
That is pretty chill.
In the shadow of Big Ben again, not saying what the job was. And then like. slowly walking into the office, like, you know, logging onto Microsoft Teams, taking my sweet time, like, typing up a little description for this podcast. But anyways, my point is, you know, we had different schedules and different constraints when we started this podcast. And really, this is doesn't warrant as much attention as we're giving to it.
But also, people will wonder.
The upshot is we just realized that we could be giving ourselves time over the weekend to work on this as well. And that would make our lives less stressful. And that's what we shall do.
Yeah. And also, I think it's nice to have a podcast release on a Monday, because I quite like having something to listen to on a Monday.
Yeah, I mean, we get a lot of comments from people saying, you know, oh, I'm glad an episode came out for me to listen to on my commute and whatnot. So I imagine, in my head, everyone is very pleased about this change. Thank you guys for being so pleased and so supportive in my head.
So yeah, if you like this episode, then please give us a 5-star review on your podcast catcher of choice and tell a friend about it, because we don't advertise this because it's just too special. We're too artisanal.
Yeah, absolutely. And do feel free to leave us a comment on Spotify, and we will try to read out a couple of our most favoritist comments on every episode, such as we are about to do now. Thank you to Grawls, who said, I listened to this podcast while I was having a root canal operation. Very informative and distracting. That's
as
so
if your
sweet.
Day couldn't get any worse.
I mean, I had a root canal when I was 7, and they put me on so much Valium. And I can't imagine, if I put myself back in the headspace of being on that much Valium, I cannot imagine what listening to this podcast would do to me. But
why is Bob Dylan here?
Yeah. But clearly it didn't break your brain, so well done. I mean, yeah, I remember, like, my mom wouldn't let me, like, you know, go to my room alone, because I was, like, deliberately walking face first into walls and like laughing about it. And I imagine that even in a state of sobriety, that's what listening to our podcast feels like. And thanks also to Callum, who says, can't believe Olivia is a harrying of the North apologist, SMH. I'm sorry, but like, if you're telling me that you wouldn't indulge in just a little bit of harrying of the North as a treat, then I don't trust you. Like, you would, wouldn't you?
No!
Wouldn't you, Aaron? You'd harry.
No!
You would harry the North.
No!
Oh, unbelievable.
You don't even want to know her opinions about Armenians. Joke. That was a joke.
No offense, but like, I just think...
No. We're not letting you get any further.
I just think the star-bellied sneeches should, like, fuck off.
That's what that was about. Wasn't he also a Nazi? A bit?
Well, he wrote Horton Hears a Who about, you know, how he felt bad about being a racist.
More like Horton Hears a...
No, it's not the Japanese! Jesus! He liked my people. We were always cool with him.
Anyway, on that note...
On that beautiful note.
Take it easy. Oh, next week, we're doing a long-awaited episode.
Yes. Should we? Can we spoil it?
Are we spoiling it? We often spoil it.
We often spoil it. I mean, it feels like I would be breaching the trust that exists between podcaster and audience to not refer to it with the name that you and I have
the
been
working title.
Referring to it for like a year, yeah. Which is the Jepisode. More specifically, it is our Passover special.
Yes.
A look at medieval Judaism.
Yes.
And not just specifically or even perhaps at all anti-Semitism, but
yes.
Rather...
Can you write a history of Judaism that is not primarily a history of anti-Semitism? I have no idea, but I'm going to try and dig my way out of this hole.
Time for this Jew and her goy friend to find out.
All right, take it easy.